everyone. I'm Luis Vargas, and you're listening to episode 57 of the Art Scene Podcast. Today's guest is Meryl Pataki, a mixed media artist based here in the Bay Area, who most especially is known for her work in neon. Meryl is not only a practitioner of the medium in terms of blowing her own glass and constructing the pieces herself, but she is also an advocate of the medium itself, always willing to share whatever knowledge she has about it to other aspiring artists, as well as educating collectors and conservation experts on how to properly care and preserve the works themselves. Before I play this awesome conversation between Meryl and I wanted to plug a couple things happening here in the Bay Area, starting with the Pasita Abad Show over at SF MoMA, which closes on January 28th. It's the first retrospective of Abad's work, featuring 40 works of her signature Trapunto paintings, which are quilted canvases. Be sure to check that out. Over at Part 2 Gallery, there are two solo shows on exhibit, one by Squeak Kornrath featuring her paintings and works on paper, and another by Martha Shaw featuring a survey of her work from the 1980s to the present. Both are on view till February 16th. Okay, now here's my conversation with Meryl Pataki, where we discuss her early beginnings as a mixed media artist, her own practice as a neon artist, and her involvement in co-founding the organization She Bends, which aims to build a more equitable future for neon. We also discuss First Light, Rituals of Glass and Neon Art, an exhibition over at the Contemporary Jewish Museum in San Francisco, which features neon artworks by various artists, including Meryl. All right, here's our conversation. Thanks, Meryl, for coming on. Good to be here in your studio, which, by the way, it's actually a lot cooler than I expected it to be. And I actually thought you were in the East Bay for some reason. Yeah. I didn't know that you were, like, here in the city off of Bryant Street.
A rare breed, I am.
Yeah. Yeah, actually kind of cool to see, like, an actual neon artist studio, because I most of the time, which I kind of want to touch on a little bit later, most of the artists or artwork I see neon related is like in a museum, because historically it's, you know, it had its peak and at one point, and now it's kind of like not as many people are doing it, but I feel like it's kind of making a comeback now.
For sure.
But for me, like my day job is I work in museums and deal with museum collections. So most of the time I'm more familiar with neon works where they're older, dead artists.
Right.
And that's it.
Yeah.
And that's totally. The only time I see them. Yeah. And so this.
Or your liquor store.
That's right. Yeah. And so to be in a studio, artist studio, who's actively making it and seeing how it's like being made and seeing like all the knickknacks around is kind of pretty cool for me.
I mean, it's not something that you usually see where like the men behind the curtain, so
that's
to
right.
speak.
That's right.
You know?
That's right. So I wanted to first start out by asking you, because you've been in the Bay for a long time, but you're not originally from the Bay Area, right? Where are you originally from?
Florida.
Oh, cool. So what brought you out here?
Getting as far away from Florida as possible. I mean, it definitely had its influences for sure. I wanted to go to art school. I tried my hand at UNF in Jacksonville, and it was just like, Jacksonville's not that tight. I mean, the beach is cool, obviously.
Yeah.
But, you have to drive everywhere. There's not really like too much culture unless you're like down in Miami all the time.
Right.
So, I saw an ad on the television for the Academy of Art.
Oh, really? And, all the way out in Florida?
Uh-huh.
Wow.
Yeah, they were really targeting.
Wow.
And, you know, I mean, it's like a private university, so they have the funds to do that. And so I came out here and I went to school here.
Wow. And the... That the ad like the sold you on the city of San Francisco, or did you do a visit first and kind of?
I think I watched some movies. I didn't do a visit. Okay. I watched some movies.
What movies?
There's like this really sad one with Keanu Reeves and Charlize Theron,
which was that one?
She's like dying. Something November, and then there's another one. Oh, the one with Matthew McConaughey and. Oh, wait, I'm totally wrong. I don't know which one, actually. It's a funny one, though. It's a funny one with... Who was that girl in Something About Mary? I'm blanking.
Oh, Cameron Diaz.
It's with Cameron Diaz, Christina Applegate, and Selma Blair.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know what I'm talking about? So weird.
That's right. I know exactly what you're talking
Listeners,
about.
Listeners, if
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I know. My wife likes that movie, too. It's actually a pretty good. It's like such a, like.
It's a chick comedy.
It's such a chick flick.
And they're like,
but it's actually a pretty good San Francisco movie,
yeah,
I feel like.
It's a really good San Francisco movie. Because you get to see a lot of the sights. There's obviously Dirty Harry,
yes,
too.
That's right. Yeah, yeah.
Which, by the way, he shoots at a neon sign on the rooftop of one of the gunfights at Washington Square, and it goes all crazy with the sparks and everything.
Yeah.
Does not happen in real life, so that was fake. But, yeah, San Francisco, I didn't know anybody, and I just kind of came out and wung it or winged it.
Yeah. And so then you, all right, so you came out to the Academy of Art University. Mm-hmm. All right, so tell me, and before we even get to that part, what was like living in Florida then? Because like, was it when you were living in Florida, were you always kind of in art? Like, was that always kind of like, this is your goal? Like, even when you were going to school out there,
yeah,
was that kind of always the trajectory?
Like, I think so.
To be an artist?
Yeah, I think so. I had like Erector sets when I was way young.
Yeah.
I like thought I was going to be an accessory designer, and I actually had like this like really cool blotter paper on my desktop that my mom would get me that's just plain like sketch pad paper but really big.
Yeah.
And I would draw out my ideas for like purses and jewelry and things like that. And as it happened, I ended up getting into a lot of metal arts at the Academy of Art long before I did neon, and most of my time at the Academy was with silversmithing.
Yeah.
So I did end up becoming an accessory designer in a way. But then my last semester, I took neon, and that kind of, like, took me with the tide.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I think I always really enjoyed that. I did painting and stuff in high school, and then I thought I was going to go to RISD. But the schools that I went to didn't really, like, foster and support that and the arts that much. And it was very, like, Ivy League-tracked, you know, school. And so it was one style of learning. They didn't really like recognize like, oh, she really excels in this area and is like really applying herself in this area. So I feel like I got a little bit shafted by my like high school and like, especially my high school education. I got a little bit like shafted there. I think that it's really important to like really foster what kids are interested in, especially when it's haptic, manual, creativity, because different people learn different things at different rates. But anyways, yeah, and then at UNF there wasn't really like, you had to take a lot of classes before. One of the reasons why I wasn't really jiving at UNF was because you have to do a whole bunch of like crazy liberal arts classes like before you even get into any studios. Right. So it's like a year and a half before you're even like doing any studio art. And I just like, I want to do art. I want to like get my hands dirty, you know? And the Academy of Art seemed like, you know, the sculpture department at least seems like just like, you know, hit the ground running. Like as soon as you're in there, you're doing foundations classes, like drawing and painting and foundation sculpture. So like the first semester you're like playing with clay and like getting your hands dirty, which is what I wanted.
That's so interesting that they like, even my undergrad, like, which was like a private Catholic university, like if you took an intro to drawing, at least you were like drawing, like be doing stuff.
Yeah.
I was like just wasting your time with like art history and then writing, and that was it.
Yeah, and math.
And math, yeah. Well, yeah, like the general education stuff.
I think maybe they probably should have taught more math at the Academy, but it was definitely something that was waived.
Yeah, yeah.
I substitute teach now. I have like almost the entire time I've been in San Francisco. I've been like doing work with kids, subbing or being an art elective teacher, after school coordinator, or something like that. And I have noticed that like when you're having to like help kids with their like math homework or something like that, you really, really have a good understanding of like where you're at, what grade level of math are you at? And I would say that I would say that I'm about a seventh grade level of math.
Well, I fear for when I didn't take math in college at all, just by the sheer luck of like taking an AP class, and I met the requisite, and I was like, don't have to take math. I was like, yeah. But I fear for when my kid gets to high school and I have to do that.
Oh my God, I know.
I'm sure whatever math updates they have done in those years is going to be so absurd that I won't even be able to help them.
Just this week I was subbing for the math teacher at I'm an elective teacher at Synergy High School. Synergy School is a primary school up to middle school on Valencia in the Mission. And I do the art electives, so I'm there like once or twice a week teaching them an elective class that they like sign up for, you know, outside of their normal every day. And so I do art, and I sub every once in a while. I was subbing for the math teacher, and I did like word problems this week. And the kids were asking me questions about it, and I'm like, it's like so hard not to admit that like you had to read it like a few times. Why don't we talk this out together?
Yeah.
That's exactly what I said. And they actually taught me a lot of stuff, and I was like, they're talking it out. I'm like, okay, yeah. No, actually, I think that might be 30. They're like, oh, yeah, it's 30. I'm like, oh, my God, we're getting through this together.
That's amazing.
It was stuff about roses, and if there's two roses and three carnations, and you have to make this many, flower arrangements, blah, blah, blah. I don't know. So that was interesting. But anyways, we got a little off topic, didn't we?
No, it's great. So that was your UNF experience, and then you were like, all right, I'm out of here.
I'm out of here.
And you made it. You got
watched
to
some movies.
Yeah, watched some movies.
Had some nightmares about earthquakes. came out anyway.
And you came out to the Academy of Art. Okay, so now how was the Academy of Art University once you got here? Like, what was that transition?
I think that the Academy is a very interesting place. It was, first of all, the Academy of Art College when I first started. And then
so it didn't even
accredited.
Have the university
Correct.
Yet. Okay.
It became accredited. I'm that old, I guess. I don't know. Because that was, early 2000s. I definitely took my time. And I think that that's one thing that even though it prolongs the experience and perhaps you end up paying more, having to take out more loans, doing it in 4 years is insane.
Yeah.
And I think especially with studio classes, or trying to rush through it in 4 years, taking breaks, which I did, I took some breaks. I did some part-time classes and worked and stuff and kind of paced myself is what I mean.
Yeah.
Because sculpture, for example, which is what I fell into, I had the opportunity to really take my time and figure out what my disciplines were and what I enjoyed. And I think that the people who rush through 4 years of it and just do bam, 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 they don't ever get a break. They don't ever get to the proverbial stepping back and examining your work type of thing.
Sure.
You need that perspective. But I liked it, and it definitely is different now than it was then. Mm-hmm. I benefited from being at the sculpture department during a time where they really valued conceptual art and installation-based art, where they were teaching artists how to write about their work. They were teaching artists what it means to use certain materials, that everything can be intentional, or if you're going to have it be not intentional or, haphazard, it needs to be intentionally that way. Things like that, the meaning behind why you're making things, now it's a little bit more about studio art and you getting a job either in someone else's studio as someone who can create stuff, or it's making maquettes for Lucasfilm, because that's a huge industry. And
right.
The Academy of Art needs to be able to tell their students that there's going to be a return on their investment to go
right.
to school.
Right.
And they wanted to continue getting enrollments for these departments that are generally not getting as many enrollments. Fine art,
Sure.
I think that the fashion school gets more enrollments, things like graphic design, obviously, and film.
Yeah.
They have a pretty good film department. But the fine art stuff, they wanted to really show students that they had a good return on investment. So they'll partner with industries to do hires, right? And Lucasfilm is a really big one. So that started to affect their curriculums and the type of classes they were offering. And so now it's very, it's a very figurative focused sculpture department still. Learn how to make figurative maquettes for them to be either cast in bronze for public art or, at Lucasfilm, for example, smaller maquettes to be made into bigger things. They tried to shut down the welding department. Luckily, they weren't successful there. They've had a couple of directors kind of stand their ground about that. But the conceptual art stuff, I don't think is as prevalent there as it was when I went there. So I really, I feel very grateful that I was there at the time that I was there.
Let me ask you this. When you were, once you were going through that, you were you committed to like then coming out of it as a full-time artist? Or because you mentioned you teach, you know, like, mm-hmm. were you thinking of being like an art teacher or?
Yeah. I'm so much better at planning now in my life than I was then.
Yeah. Well, we all are, I guess.
Right? I think it took me a little while to like find my footing and what I really enjoyed. So there's that. And then by the time I graduated, it was really just kind of like look for anything that's out there. You know, like I literally applied for anything art related. And at the time, you know, tech was coming up again in the city. And so whenever you would type in art, it was all tech jobs, right? Mm-hmm. So it was kind of hard to find. I think that I knew I wanted to continue making work, but I think I knew pretty well that I was going to need to find something that was a plan B, and teaching was something that had always kind of been in the back of my mind. I got my first teaching job at Schools of the Sacred Heart down on in the marina, and I was doing the after-school program, so I ended up becoming the arts coordinator for the after-school program. I worked there for a few years, and I also did subbing there as well, which has kind of kick-started my whole teacher side gig. And I worked that for a relatively long time. I think about my goal was, okay, 5 years after I graduate, I'm going to have a neon studio. And I pretty much hit that mark. Really, one of the reasons I guess I got super lucky, which is strange to say, because what catapulted me to being able to afford buying a shop that went out of business, which is how most people get into this business, sure. is they buy equipment from other shops that have gone out of business. It's way too pricey to buy it new. I was, you know, doing my thing, like subbing here, tutoring there, nannying here, you know, whatever, biking around the city like a dirty bike kid. And I got into an accident, and someone doored me, and I don't even remember the accident still. I got a traumatic brain injury.
Oh, no.
And the person, the guy that I was working for at the time, the dad of the kids that I was nannying, was an accident attorney. So he helped me get, like, the minimum liability coverage that the person had, which was 15 grand. And I bought equipment, and I bought a car. Cause I still have a lot of like trauma kind of sure. riding my bike around, which is so sad because I loved it so much.
Yeah.
I've gotten back into it now that I live in Vallejo. I hop on the ferry every once in a while and I'll ride the like 10 minutes to my studio. But, yeah, I guess, I got lucky in the sense that like I didn't die.
Right. Silver lining is you didn't die.
Right.
And you got 15 grand.
And I got 15 grand. Yeah. And I bought some equipment.
Yeah.
Some guy was, you know, in the community was a lot of people go, they hear about shops going out of business. They go and they collect the shit, you know, they'll drive and collect the stuff and then they'll try and sell it.
Yeah.
And so I got stuff to start me out. And my neon teacher at the time, his name's Bill Concannon. He's in Crockett. He is a legend. We can maybe talk about him a little bit.
Sure.
He helped me out significantly, getting the equipment, just advising me on all manner of things. He also helped me process my stuff because it's one thing to bend it in the fires.
Yeah.
I had bending equipment, but I didn't have any of the like heavy duty, like high current processing equipment set up yet. I was a little scared of that, which I think is certainly a healthy fear anybody should have going into neon because it's extremely dangerous. So I didn't set up my bombarding equipment for a couple years after I had set up bending, and he was helping me process stuff. So I would go to Crockett, help him out in his studio, and he would process stuff for me. And now I'm like, as I'm talking, I'm kind of realizing that like now that's what I do for other people, you know? So that makes me smile. The girl who left before you got here was helping me clean, and I'm going to, you know, help her out in some way, like with bending or processing her stuff.
So let me ask, was he your teacher dating back to like academy?
Yeah,
he
was the neon teacher at the Academy of Art, which unfortunately that program no longer runs.
So they had like a specific neon program there.
Well, it was a class.
It was like a class.
And it was within the sculpture department.
Oh, that's really cool.
It is.
Yeah.
And they still have all the equipment, but it's not set up. It's in a storage room. They don't run the
so
class.
It's just sitting there unused.
I'm in contact finally now with the new director of the sculpture department who I actually went to school with. He was a graduate student when I was doing my undergrad. and we're trying to figure something out.
Well, I was going to mention, like, what's stopping you from, I mean, you're a teacher now, like, to, like, try and see if you can.
I hope, that's, fingers crossed, some things are in the works. Either I'll get my hands on some equipment, or they can donate it for a loss, and I can, you know, run some more workshops, or sell some it. I don't know.
Yeah.
This, who knows what's going to happen, but the ideal situation would be that I get to teach at the academy.
Yeah. Okay. So tell me about your experience as well with this professor, with this dude.
Bill Concannon.
Yeah.
Okay. So Bill Concannon worked with a guy named Larry Albright, who is rest in peace, is a neon and plasma wizard. The two of them had a lot of fun in LA working with Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of, like, I mean, they made signs, and certainly Bill now makes a lot of his living on signs, as we all do, right? We have to, because it's a very commercial medium. But they had, like, such a blast making most of their living doing neon, like, set design and special effects before CG. So they did Back to the Future, Under the DeLorean when it lifts up and drives away is neon, miniature neon inside the spaceships for Star Wars. Biff Tannen's Pleasure Paradise Hotel from Back to the Future 2 is all matte painted, where the back of the building, I think, I can't remember what's what, but there's a splice and a matte painting going on where they made this miniature. They worked in, like, 3 millimeter tubing and did all of these miniature neon pieces that were then somehow incorporated or matte painted into, not matte painted, but, like, spliced. Like, the film was spliced, you know? And it was just such a cool way to learn from somebody who had taken this commercial medium and still did it commercially, but there was such a creative, unusual way that he and Larry were using it, and a legacy, right? Like, a history to neon that most people would never know.
Mm-hmm.
That it used to be all neon in Hollywood before there was LED, before there was CG. That's how you got your linear light. Oh, Howard the Duck too.
Oh wow.
Which is the worst movie ever made.
And then he ended up at the academy teaching you then in the
he
end.
He did, yeah.
Okay, so then
he doesn't teach anymore. I think, you know, he'll pick up some mentoring, like, every once in a while. He'll, like, you know, have somebody that he's helping, but for the most part, he just does his own thing, and hopefully he'll write a book someday. I think right now he's helping the Museum of Neon Art down in Los Angeles do a Larry Albright show where they're going to be refurbishing and exhibiting some of his incredible, groundbreaking plasma works, which we can define that, I guess, in a bit. But I'll just say that all neon is plasma.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the fourth state of matter. But, like, some of it, you know, the balls that you touch in the electricity goes to your hand.
Mm-hmm.
That's an example of, like, a plasma piece. That's what we would call plasma. So scientific glass, larger tubes, bigger vessels can be filled with neon gas and become animated when they only have one source, one input of electrical current. Because a neon tube is a tube, right? It's a linear tube. And on either side is an electrode that carries the current through. So you have electrodes on either side with a current that goes through, it finds ground, or there's an alternating current. With plasma, there's only one electrode. And so that current is constantly looking for ground. And you see that animated in the animated gas that looks like little lightning bolts that are searching around the inside of the vessel looking for ground. And that's why when you touch the vessel, you're earth grounded. And so it'll come to you because you're grounded. So plasma has this amazing, plasma works, which is what we call it, even though all neon is plasma. Just not all plasma is neon, because neon's a specific gas.
Yeah.
So plasma works have the incredible ability to, like, snake and crawl, and you can combine gases, and really the possibilities are endless. And Larry Albright did phenomenal, groundbreaking plasma works, and it's still very much a field that people are experimenting with and learning from each other. It's amazing to kind of see the progression and how people help each other out through it. With neon, the same thing's been done for 100 years. I mean, there's nothing too new about it. And, you know, that's that's arguable because I curate and I'm, you know, I try to focus on people who are pushing the boundaries of the medium. So there's still some boundary pushing that's being done, but plasma, like the possibilities are endless. And so Bill, I'm sure right now is down in LA. I believe that they're trying to publish either a catalog or a book of Larry Albright's work and then also do an exhibition. And I don't know if that's public knowledge, but I just I just promoted the show for them. But yeah, Larry Albright, everybody should look him up. He's kind of a, you know, and it's, we're like wizards. I mean, yeah. It's like these old guys that taught us all are essentially like all mad scientists, and they a lot of them really look the part.
Yeah. So when you got out of school, it sounds like you were still keeping in contact with Bill.
Yeah.
Like, and he was just kind of still mentoring you and helping you, and kind of like still in that period of time.
Yeah.
And like, it sounds like he still does in some way. It sounds like he's
still keeping in contact. Yeah, I try to leave him. I try to leave him alone. You know? But yeah, it's interesting, like. It's one of those things where it's like, okay, well now I pay it forward, yeah. You know? And so now I have the ability to pay it forward and help people in the same way that he helped me. If I learned anything, you know, which I learned a lot, but that would be, you know, certainly a huge lesson is like to try and remember to be gracious with my knowledge with other people and like take the time out to do that type of stuff, which is hard, you know? I mean, it's hard to make a living for anybody these days, especially being a craftsperson. And so you don't always have a lot of time, but making the time to do that is like really important because that's how the medium survives. And also work trades, you know, are an underrated thing, I think, in our world anyways. Being able to like just do like a barter and trade with somebody is so much more valuable sometimes than money. Sure. You know, like having students in here is great. Having people pay me for lessons is great. But when people come to me and they want to learn, it's like, well, what do you do? Like, you know, how can you help the studio? Like, what are there things that would interest you around here to contribute to it? And in exchange, you know, you can get time in the fires or, you know, some lessons. So I try and look at things that way as much as possible, and I think it's because of Bill and the other people who have taken the time to, like, taken a lot of time to help me out.
Yeah. So we're looking at, what, 5 years after school, you're like, you got your equipment, the accidents happened.
Yeah. You've survived.
You got your equipment, and you're just like, you got a studio space at that point already?
Yeah, I had the studio space before, and then I transitioned it to a neon space. So I got this studio when I was still in college, and I was doing a lot more silversmithing stuff. And then I transitioned it to a neon studio, about 5 years after.
Okay, so let me ask you about that, okay, because I wanted to... So you mentioned earlier about... Because you are, like, you are a mixed-media artist. Mm. But like you also do neon seems to be the mainly, like the main thing. But you are skilled in other mediums, and you mentioned silversmithing before. Okay, so when you were in school and you're like you're finishing up, what was the thing about neon that you were like that gravitated you towards that? Like, what was it about it that you were like, this is cool doing all this silversmithing and metalwork? But what was it about neon that you were just like, this is it. This is this dying medium that nobody like is even like not many people are doing much of, but it takes this one guy out of nowhere to like mentor me to do it. Like, you know, it's like a thing that you have to like keep carrying on.
Right.
Because if you don't, it will die. You know, like why that medium?
I mean, I think that's certainly one of the reasons why it's so attractive is because like, you know, there's this like feeling of importance to it that like, you know, your involvement in it is super important to its survival and its legacy. But I think the main answer to that question, I sort of have to go back to like why I was even attracted to the metals, right? Like I like not clay, for example. Clay is fantastic. I love ceramics. I've done a lot of ceramic work and I understand the way that it works. But for me, I never sort of, that was never really my niche. Because it didn't provide enough resistance in my hand. And I think that metal, there was something about the sequence of events that gets you somewhere, right? That made sense to my brain. Like, it's not just this, like, free-flowing. Ceramics is more painterly, right? I enjoy the painterly process, but there was something about the structure that medals gave me that I guess I needed in my life.
Yeah.
And still need very much, depending on my mood. Sometimes it's love and hate. But I appreciate the resistance that those materials provide me. They teach me about myself. They cause me to critically think more than almost any other, I mean, certainly more than other mediums. And with glass, even more so, because now it's not, you can't get away with anything. Like, if it's not made well, it's not going to light up, right? So there's, like, this, like, finishing line that you have to get to. Whereas, like, with a piece of jewelry, you can make it funky. You can have, like, you know, the soldering is key. But, like, finishing doesn't always need to be perfect. It can be. But neon is very, very, like, it needs to be a certain way for it to survive and have a good shelf life, which is the challenge. Like, I like to joke that I don't shy away from confrontation as a personality trait. So I think that that's probably why I was super attracted to it. It was super challenging. It offered resistance. It didn't, you know, it's, I can't even describe it. It's like, it's a pretty magical thing how it can really shape you as a person to be working with a material like that for an extended amount of time of your life. It's taught me patience. It's made me critically think, like I've said. It's a transformative, very spiritual thing when you can get into a flow with it and when you start to build the muscle memory for it. So at first it was, well, this is hard. This is really hard, and I'm not going to let it get over on me. I'm going to, you know, climb this mountain and get on top of this challenge. And now I stay with it because I've been able to form a relationship with the medium where it's a very intimate interpersonal relationship for me and one of the most important relationships in my life that's taught me the most about myself. And sometimes I have bad days with it, like you do with any, you know, close person in your life, I guess, or thing. And today is a day I love it, I guess, if I'm talking about it like
and
this.
And I feel like you can kind of, I can see that. I feel like you can see that in your work because I think that was one of the things I gravitated towards whenever I saw pieces of yours was that I could see how you have that relationship and that else that you feel comfortable enough to even push the boundaries of that medium.
Well, you have to have the skill to be able to, you have to climb certain mountains with it, get the skill down, do things the right way. Then you can scale back. Then you can push things and you can do things the way that you're, that aren't supposed to be done. Like for me, it's not for me. I actually, it's hard because what originally attracted me to it was the challenge. It wasn't necessarily the perfection and the rigidity of you know, what the community especially imposes on it. I mean, other sign vendors tear artists apart online sometimes. It happens less frequently amazing. Now because I feel like a lot of emerging artists have really gained a voice and a lot of confidence because of certain projects that are out there, mine included, and other you know, guilds that have come up and just people gaining community, especially on social media. But I try and push back against that rigidity often because I think that unlike most mediums, neon doesn't ever really allow you to see the hand of its maker.
Yes. Well, because I'm going to bring up a couple pieces that I was like, as I mentioned earlier, my familiarity with it is just like older stuff. Naumann, Kusoth. The thing about those, I felt like what people was like, oh, their works are great, was their way of pushing the boundary was simply going from a basic neon sign to like, I'm going to do a circle piece and words in a circle and bend it and put political statements or a statement. Mm-hmm. And
subverting the commercial.
That's right.
And using it in the same aesthetic.
That's right. And at that particular point in time in history was like, that was pushing the boundaries, right?
Oh, people are still thinking that that's pushing the boundaries.
Putting it in cursive script and some whatever.
Yeah.
That's like whatever, right? And yes, you're right. Even to this day, sometimes people
are like,
people
oh,
still
it's cheeky,
do,
you know?
Right. Yeah. People will still do that and think that that's still like creative and, you know, and sometimes it is whatever, but like that's pushing the boundaries. But the thing about your piece that I thought was really cool was your pieces, you're not afraid to, like, you'll do that, but you're, like, not afraid to throw, like, freaking paint on top of it and, like, mix other mediums with it. And, like, the one piece that I was, like, this is crazy. There was one from like 2017. It was called Pass You the Hammer. Mm-hmm. That thing was, you had like found a way to bend a neon tube, but like in like this bundled, crumpled,
like a squiggle.
A squiggle. And it was like a cinder block literally like leaning on it, mm-hmm. where it was like this squiggle was like this, was just like supporting the weight of the mm-hmm. cinder block. And that was so wild to me because I'm sure there's like other tricks of the trade of like that I don't know about, but like to like the layman who's looking at this in a gallery, their idea of neon is like it's a glass tube. Mm-hmm. So the idea that this glass tube is holding the weight of like a cinder block, totally. Like was like insane. And that for me is like pushing the medium, I feel like, then just like another clever statement and neon sign. And even the recent show you had at part two, and correct me if I'm pronouncing it wrong, it was like the Ruach series, mm-hmm. where you, for lack of a better way of like describing it, but like they look like candle holders, but they're like not just simple candle holders. They're like, it's amazing, like these, whatever you did with these tubes, like that just like hold these candles, but it's the fact that you like mix the physical wax candles with like this cool neon like plasma looking like glowing thing. Like and that you put it on a pedestal, but I don't know where the power's coming from, which is like even cooler part about it. It's just like this clever part of, you know, you're just, again, it's just like another way of pushing the boundaries of how you're, one, blowing the glass, like lighting it up, and then you like you're throwing in like a different type of medium, mixed medium material with it, with these candles on it. And so I just thought that for me was how I felt that you were pushing the boundary.
I really appreciate that you enjoyed them so much. Awesome.
Well, because it's just refreshing to me, because I just like, again, like I there are, like you mentioned, there are still contemporary neon artists today that still do make neon
sign based,
but it's very sign based, mm-hmm. and that's great. But like I feel like you to go back how you, just the way you were just describing it earlier about how your relationship with that medium is, how you're like not afraid of confrontation and how you like are very comfortable with it, but you had to like work hard to get comfortable with it. You could see that in the way you're making the work and how it comes out. Yeah. And these two pieces alone, I feel like must have been at one point in the studio, you were just like cussed and swear at one point in frustration to get it to that point where you figured it out.
Like, or where I was like, I want to squash it with a cinder block.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, no, totally. Yeah. I appreciate that you say all that, because certainly like the candle holders are where I'm at now, right, with things. And those are actually made out of borosilicate glass, which is a scientific glass. It's Pyrex. It's different than typical neon tubing. And glass in general hates inconsistency, and that's what those tubes have all over them, is twists and folds and areas where I puffed it out, areas where I sucked it in, right? Like there's a lot going on, and it's still so very simple and I think really elegant, the movement of it. And so in that way, I'm not just like, I feel like with the cinder block piece, I'm still making things the way that they should be. The tube is the same size all the way around. It's just got the cinder block, you know, resting on it or you know, on top of the piece. I'm pushing the medium physically in that way. And I feel like with the candle holder pieces, I'm really pushing things not only physically, but like conceptually, like with the process of it all. And I'm pushing myself too, because that was a brand new process for me. Working borosilicate, you know, all glass has certain traits about it that you can carry from one process to the next. But like, I don't just because I've done neon for 15 years doesn't mean I go into a hot shop and I know how to blow glass. Mm-hmm. The only thing that I know about glass is that gravity takes it down when it slumps, right? And doing 15 years of neon really lends itself to me learning the scientific glass process, which is borosilicate. It has a higher slumping point. I have to use oxygen in my burners. I don't use my own burners because I don't have them. They're very expensive. I had to go to Bay Area Glass Institute in San Jose to learn.
Wow.
So, you know, I formed community around that process, a new community around that process. And I became a student again after so many years of kind of just doing the same thing, you know, like this is how neon works and trying to push the boundaries with it. But you can only really go so far, I think, with it. And I had to kind of, I guess, level up, as they say, is go to borosilicate, have a hotter flame, and you can really slow down with the material. With soft glass, which is what neon is made of, it's the same as furnace glass. Hot shop maker, you know, hot shop people, they pull tubes. That's where neon tubes come from, is the furnace.
Okay.
So it's the same coefficiency rate, mm-hmm. which means that it has a lower slumping point, and you also have to work it faster. So neon tubes, most people will work a piece from start to finish, or, you know, a unit at least, and not really have a lot of stopping in between. With boro, you can really, really, you can be working a piece for months, you know. You just put it away in a kiln, bake it out, relieve the stress from the glass, take it out of the kiln once it's cooled, and just start over again. So at any point, you can work some areas of it, fold it, twist it, do all these things, like stay in one area of the glass, working that one area of the glass till however long you want. And then just put it away in a kiln, let it, you know, have a little sleepover overnight, and take it out the next day and continue working on stuff, which you cannot do with soft glass. I mean, but then coming back into the neon studio and doing some repairs and doing some difficult work, where I had an opportunity to see how the boro has influenced my neon studio practice, and it's a game changer. Like, I feel like both things informed each other. I leveled up with how I'm able to push boundaries in glass. I became a student again, and that's, I think, critical at any stage in your practice, is like never to let things get stale, always to go back to being a student with something, because sure. it can really invigorate stuff and allow you to like go further down the path of what your like mission is with the practice.
Yeah. Yeah. The thing about, but it's also interesting about you is that learning and teaching the methods of this medium seems to be very, very important to you. Mm-hmm. You mentioned you teach on the side. Do you get to incorporate any of that into like
what
you
with middle like
yeah
school?
Yeah? Do you get to?
I wish more. I did do one when I was pregnant, like crazy. I like took all of this. We're sitting next to this portable equipment that I have next to us right now, and so I'm able to do demos out in the world. And I brought all of this portable equipment to the middle school. They had been spending the semester learning how to make patterns.
Yeah.
And then they tried their hand at it, and they just like, you know, they spent a little, like one, each person had a little session in the fire, and they made a little squiggle, and then they moved on. but I want to incorporate it into youth programming even more. My organization, She Bends, is gearing up to do a show with the Museum of Craft and Design next year, where we're going to do residencies with different teaching artists that are going to teach young people. But yeah. I think we're probably going to start with 18-year-olds. But I do workshops in here. I've had my share of teenagers in here learning.
That's cool.
So yeah, not as much as I would like. I mean, obviously there's a lot of liability involved in that, but anytime, bring it on.
Well, let's talk about She Bends, because I feel like that seems to be a perfect segue.
Yeah.
Because that, from what I have read and heard about She Bends, that seems to be the perfect extension of what I was talking about, like this way of spreading the word about neon, and not only just in a way to exhibit it, but to like educate people about it and to like
and push the boundaries
and push the boundaries about it and learn and have people learn about it. And you, it's like a way for you to learn about it more about it too, and like in your own practice. So, tell me about it. How did this idea get conceived?
Yeah. So, like, I don't know, back in, I can't even remember when it was, 2016 or 2017, I got wind of, like, some Women in Neon show that was going on in London, and I took a look at the roster, and, like, no hate or whatever, but, like, only, like, two of them bent glass if I wasn't sure, I looked it up, and
what do you mean by that? Like, they actually made the work.
And they're calling it Women in Neon, and I'm like, but these aren't the Women in Neon.
And the rest were like, we're contracting it out. Yeah, you mean like, I mean, so they would like design it and have someone else
make
it
for them? Four out of five pieces of neon work that you see in museums or in any gallery isn't made by the artist, which is one of the reasons why She Bends needed to exist. Not only to highlight historically marginalized people in the industry, but to highlight artists that are making it themselves.
Which, by the way, spoiler to anybody listening, like, in general, a lot of sculptures and a lot of artwork are actually not handmade by the artists. They're just, like, contracted out to foundries and whatever.
Which,
so, like,
which I want to note that, like, it's fine, but you're only ever going to exist with that piece within the societal interpretations of what that medium means,
right?
So, like, if it's neon, it's almost always going to end up being some sort of sign-based commercial work.
Right.
If you're commissioning it out.
Right.
What Bill would tell me sometimes, because he'd made a lot of work for artists, and I've talked to a lot of different makers about this and how they feel about it. And most people are pretty chill. The older you get, the less you care about this shit, which is what people were telling me 10 years ago. And they were right. I care a lot about it. I was like, fuck those people, you know? Like,
but at least a co-credit would be, like, better if you were going to do that, right?
Yeah, or I think that there's a time and a place for that. In a catalog, in a special thing.
Right.
Not on the title, on the title tag of the piece, which some people feel like they're entitled to. Imagine telling an indigenous or black artist that you, a white male vendor, is entitled to having your name on the piece next, or on the title tag next to the work. That's my argument for it. No, you are not entitled to that.
Yeah.
But you got paid for a job. You did your job.
That's right.
But that's how I feel about it now. Before, I was all up in arms about it. And I think that I've come to the center and I've learned, you know, there are those people who never give their vendors credit. Their work is predominantly neon, and they never tell anybody that they it's this whole, like, facade, which you can kind of pick up on. Uh-huh. I don't like that. But, like, for example, and I love his work, Patrick Martinez hires his work out, which is perfect, actually, for his piece. And it's something that I
actually didn't know that.
I always talk about this because his work is about the landscapes of Los Angeles, which is, it's like, of course. And the person that bends his stuff is Latino. So I think that it's a perfect symbiosis of, like, concept feeding, you know, local crafts, local, you know, trade. And he's contributing to the industry.
Right.
He's working local with a sign vendor.
Right.
He, you know, if you're a neon person and you look at his work, you can see things that are done in the bending of that piece that are very quintessentially commercial, like, hacks. You know, like, oh, he did it this way because, like, this is how it's done commercially to get stuff out, you know? Right. And it has that look, and that's what he wants. So it's perfect for his work. And the process of him hiring it out, I think, speaks to the concepts of his work, right? So I there's no shade whatsoever. His work is phenomenal, and I love the little ecosystem, or, you know, the symbiosis that he has existing between his work and his bender, and his bender's livelihood and his livelihood. Like, it's great. It's wonderful. And then there's people who don't have that happening, right? So I used to be all up in arms about it. That's kind of what started the She Bends thing, was that it was like, the show called Women in Neon only has two people that I know for a fact bend neon. If I was unsure, I looked it up, I did some research, found out that I was right, that they don't bend neon. And I don't think that anybody in the show was hiding that fact necessarily, but it's not the women in neon. I know who the women in neon are, you know? Like we who are friends with each other on Instagram, for example, know who we are. They should be highlighted. So I reached out to the Museum of Neon Art, and I asked them if they were interested in a show, and some things happened, and you know, I think that they had somebody who was interested in curating something like that actually ended up not doing it. So then they came back to me and asked me, and that's how She Bends was born. It was just the name of the exhibition. After that, it went on, I pitched the idea to Midway Gallery in San Francisco to take the work that was coming down from Mona and having it there, plus maybe adding some more pieces. And Midway accepted, and I got to work with Kelsey Issel, who was the gallery director at the time at the Midway. She's now my business partner and co-owner of She Bends, and does all of the programming and, you know, kind of the public engagement side of She Bends. I mean, she's definitely responsible for building it into how engaging it is now. And we really are, you know, whereas before it was like this traveling survey exhibition where it's spectacular, and there's a lot of neon in one room, and we just packed the place full, and here's all the women in neon, right? Which even then, like, wasn't all the women in neon, right?
Right.
The Midway show had over 75 works of art, probably close to, like, 100 or so works of art, and it was a huge to-do. We are, you know, now after COVID and everything like that, kind of getting into more of like a culture worker type of curatorial vibe, where we're paring things down, we're getting more thematic and very conceptual with the things that we want to curate. We're picking artists that really work within the themes that we're thinking about. And yeah, we're probably going to go forward in that direction, and yeah, do public demos and educational programming, hopefully bringing in more youth's programming for stuff and fostering a new generation of, you know, queer, female, just underrepresented artists in neon. And not only centering those narratives, but also bringing to the attention of fine arts institutions, blue chip galleries, and conservation. Talking, you know, we're doing things with Getty Conservation Institute right now around conserving neon and sort of impressing upon people that, look, this is no longer a situation where you just go to a neon sign shop and you have them remake the unit. Like, first of all, you have to consider artist intent. A lot of artwork is not going to be sign-based anymore, where it's just like straightforward remakes, right? Mm-hmm. You have art from artists that like are super intentional, pushing the boundaries that not anybody can just make, right? Could you imagine like somebody trying to conserve one of my candle holders and just going to a neon sign shop and asking them to do that? Like there's a new way to look at neon, and it's, you know, on the horizon. And in order to foster neon into the future, you have to also make sure that you're talking to the people who are giving it space and going to be conserving it into the future too.
Like, a really good point about that. I work, like as I mentioned earlier, I work in my day jobs. I work with collections management at the museums, and that seems to be the trend moving forward. Is that we're, as museums and conservators and registrars and collections managers and even curators at museums are having to, are collecting more and more contemporary artists, and artists are alive more than they are dead. Mm-hmm. And as a result, and a lot of the mediums are more complex and crazy, and they're not their traditional painting and photographs where they're very straightforward. And there's by the book ways of like fixing them or conserving them and preserving them for the future.
Right.
So they're like weird materials that like don't preserve in the same way. And so it's trending towards, we have to be more in contact with the artists from the moment the work is like acquired to be able to take that voice, because when they're dead, what they're not available anymore to like be, to talk to. Mm-hmm. So now they're more in conversation. They're trying to be, but not all the museums are good at it because they're still old school thinking.
Right.
Where they're like, and they're, because they're mostly dealing with dead artists.
Right.
But they're like trying, they have to be more in contact with the artists now to get that information as much as possible. And every time they show, but it's not happening in the majority of the time. It's still happening the minority of the time. Mm. But you're right. Like the fact that you, that are dedicated to doing that, is really good.
Getty Conservation Institute, it had just hosted a symposium with neon professionals around trying to make like guidelines for conserving neon. And the funny, I mean, you know, it was a really enriching conversation, a lot of really interesting things to say, stories about how they just recently did a touring exhibit of Carissa's work in New York, and then it's going to the Manil. I think it might already be there, and I'm going to be going to Manil to do a talk for the Carissa show in February, and I hope to really talk about not only women in neon, but like the conservation aspect of it and the future generation of it and the new narratives around it. And one of the people that I'm talking with is Matt Dilling from Light Bright Neon, which is a really artist heavy, like they do a lot of work for blue chip artists that are working in neon today. So Andrea Schwartz, I think she's doing a huge project at the San Francisco airport, actually, for Harvey Milk. That's going to have neon in it that sort of emulates the design of the Castor Theater.
Oh, that's really cool.
And Light Bright is doing that work. Lightbright's done a lot of work by contemporary artists that you've seen over the last few years. And one of their main things is talking, and this is something that all neon sign shops should do if they're making work for artists, and what artists should know when they're hiring neon sign shops to make their work is how you want it preserved, how you want it taken care of. Andrea Schwartz is, I don't know if I have that right. I think it's her name. I'm so embarrassed, but I love her work. One of her main things for a series of her work for conservation, and she worked with Lightbright on this, was that she doesn't care the type of glass that's being used for remakes. They have to be from scrap. Mm-hmm. It can't be new sticks pulled, because the work is all about the climate, environmentalism, you know, the future, things like that. So she makes it a point to say it needs to be scrap glass from other projects. It can't be new glass pulled from a case, you know. Those are things to consider when you're making work. For example, with my candle holders, are they ephemeral works? Do I want them refilled? Can they be refilled? If it breaks, like, can anybody actually remake that? It's never going to look the same, you know. Mm-hmm. Those are all things that very rigid processes like conservation need to be more fluid about. And then also, like, they need to be more modable or movable in that respect. Like, knowing when to be very strict about how to preserve or conserve neon sign based work, and how to and when to sort of be a little bit less stringent about that and listen to what artists want, or, you know, understand that certain things might not be able to be conserved, you know. And also, you know, there's a couple of voices in the room at that symposium that were like, we're mining out our resources, y'all. Like, all of this is mined stuff. You know, all the phosphors that we use, all of the expensive glass that we use is all coming out from the Congo and everything. And artists are way more involved in and aware of those processes. And so, yeah, I think, you know, doing things in a way that are responsible and according to what the artist would want is really, like, should be the first step.
Mm-hmm. Very right. And it's... And again, it's like still a new concept, because I think a lot of older museums are still, you would think in this day and age, and I learned this the hard way, because at one of the previous museums I worked at, the head conservator was very progressive, and everything you just said was lectured to me by her. Mm. And so every processes in terms of acquisitions, when we ever acquire everything, that was embedded in the acquisition
process. Oh, yeah, there's a very strict intake process, for sure. It has to be that way.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And so everything you just said was always taken into account, and that was But I was very surprised when I went to other places, or at least learned from other places, that that was actually not common. Mm, yeah. And I thought it just was. And it turns out that it was, like, still a growing, like, idea.
Yeah.
And I think a lot
with
of
many
it,
mediums is what you mean?
Yeah. All mediums. Yeah. Not just neon. But
I bet, like, neon is kind of the worst of it, because it's so ubiquitous that so few people actually know anything about it.
Well, it's like... Well, yes, like there's that aspect of it about neon that even makes it more difficult mm-hmm. to evaluate because of its medium, and it's a medium, as I mentioned, that, like, because it kind of had this period of where it faded away and there's, like, less experts on it.
Right.
And now, like, it's coming back, so then it's, like, trying to find who the new experts are. So, like, there's that period that makes it even harder, but applying the same ideas, the same concepts that you just mentioned are applied to what do we do with the candles? Do they get replaced?
Right.
That gets applied to even what kind of paint do we use to repaint the surface.
Or what color glass? Like, you know, is helium going to be around forever? Is neon going to be around forever? Mm-hmm. The price of neon is going up significantly.
That's right.
Are we going to be able to use mercury in some of our tubes? Yeah. Which, by the way, we don't use in all tubes. But, you know, that's something that in Sweden, for example, is going to be banned probably in a couple of years. They're not going to be able to use a really core component of the tube. So they don't make leaded glass anymore, for example.
Well, one of the things I remember on the job, there was an instance where a painting needed to be retouched. And sometimes it's a matter of just, like, finding the paint.
Right.
And you touch it up with the paint. The conservators know how to do that. But the thing is, what about a lot of the paints from the 50s? Mm-hmm. The paint that people used was, like, leftover, like, paint from the war, that was, like, excess paint that they used to paint ships, like naval ships. But it was only during that period of time that they did that. So once you ran through the paint, it's gone. They didn't make any more of that paint.
Right.
So if you wanted to touch up the paint, you don't, there's not like any lying around in excess anymore. It's gone.
Right.
And so how do you retouch it? Yeah. And if you retouch it with anything else, it won't look right.
And that's something that we're seriously going through in neon for sure.
And the thing that they were like, it is what it is.
Yeah.
Then it's that, that's how it looks. And that's, and that was how they had to, in either, and they had to make a decision of it's no longer exhibitable. And we just have to preserve it for as long as we can until it gets worse, until it's not exhibitable anymore, or we just no longer show it and put it in storage, mm-hmm. or we deaccession it, or whatever the, you know, whatever the internal debate is in the institution. And so there's things like that that they have to decide. There were things where, if luckily, if the artist was still alive, they would have conversations like, where are you okay if we use this paint? Here's the situation we have. Can we have, Can we talk about the different types of paint? What are you happy with?
Yeah.
And then getting that on the record from them and having them understand and that, having that in conversation. But again, that that part of it, sometimes not every institution does that. They feel like they don't need to do that because I own it. I don't, and that's the problem. And
Well, that or it's simply not available, right? I mean, we definitely go through that with the neon. I mean, for a straight 6 months or so, we didn't have a white.
That's
right. 6500 white is our most common white color. That's just completely gone.
Yeah.
The thing with the neon, though, is that it's like, I mean, and Carissa was really big on this, too. She didn't care if it had to look different. She didn't care how it looked, right? And so, or you know, would say, like, well, if it's not able to be done, like, I don't, you know, don't break your back over it or whatever.
Yeah, that's right.
So,
well, and sometimes, by the way, that conversation would happen at the front end before acquisition.
Right.
And it could make or break whether they were even going to acquire.
Well, I think that all artists should be aware of that.
Yeah.
You never know when you're going to hit the big time.
Yeah. No, you never know. But it sucks. And sometimes it sucks because there have been times where I've seen it happen where they're like, we want to do this. And then they'll present it to the team at the museum. Mm-hmm. And there's in the room, the conservators and the collection managers are like, what?
Right.
Like, okay, well, what happens if that breaks? Do we have permission? Have you talked to the artist, curator?
Well, a lot of why, like, museums don't have enough neon in their permanent collections is because they don't have they don't have the resources to preserve it, or they're scared of collecting it. They don't they don't want to deal with it. And 100%. A lot of that is, like, a lack of education.
100%. 100%. And I have been in a room where that was said.
Yeah.
And I have friends who work at other places here in the Bay where...
They're just like,
they straight up
it.
Was like, we're not taking that.
Yeah.
And like that friend was like, I am qualified. Guys, we can take it. I have the experience to, but as an institution, we're not.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, okay. Yeah. And then that was like how sad that was.
It's sad. Yeah. And one of our artists says, like, you know, neon really gets invited to the party. It's so true in the sense in the craft world, it's relatively new, only about 200 years old compared to so many other crafts that are like centuries old.
Yeah.
You know, and then so in the glass within the glass community, it's not really taken as seriously. Yeah. And then in the fine art world, it's not really as an actual process driven sculpture, or, you know, a sculpture process driven sculptural fine art form. It's not, you know, it's not anywhere near where it should be, considering the fact that we literally make light out of thin air.
Well, that's great, though, that like that's one of the things with Cheap Ends that you're all trying to do is like be part of that conversation to like help educate institutions. Like, it's not just like this thing where it's more than just teaching workshops and like exhibiting your works. It's like you're trying to be part of the larger conversation of how do we like conserve the medium in itself to live like and have it collected.
Yeah.
And not have people be afraid to collect it, too.
Education of the general public for sure, and also like kind of centering an importance around the handmade, the artist made. Like, I talk a lot to my own industry about this, and it's something that came up in my head when we were talking. I had the honor of being able to be a speaker at Pilchuck School's first neon symposium in September. They're like a really well-known 50-year-old Dale Chihuly founded glass program in the middle of like, it looks like the woods, but it's actually like a huge tree farm in the Pacific Northwest in Washington. And it's basically like a hot shop in the middle of the woods, like a neon shop in the middle of the woods. It's like neon, it's like glass summer camp. And they had their first neon symposium. One of the things that I talked to a room full of glass makers and a lot of neon a room full of neon makers actually, and neon enthusiasts, was that a lot of times both the world, right? Conservation world, fine art world, whatever, they engage with neon in a certain capacity, right? It's sign-based, it's commercially based, you know, find a neon sign person to remake it, to reconserve it, and that's it, right? But, and we as vendors look at work by, and I've heard a lot of this, right, this gatekeepy language about, like, well, you know, if it's not made perfectly, you're giving neon a bad reputation. Because actually, and there's some merit to this, because, you know, it needs to be made in a certain way. If it's not made well, and that goes from the bending of the glass all the way to the processing of the glass, sure, which is a huge, long process, right? Once you're finished actually creating the glasswork, sure, you're not done yet, right? Yeah. Now you have to get it to light up. And so if there's flaws in that process, it ends up not having as long of a shelf life. Mm-hmm. It ends up having a bad reputation. Like, if you put out a lot of that type of work, it's giving neon a bad name because people don't want to collect it anymore if it doesn't work, if they have all these problems with it, if there's all this, like, weird stuff happening with it, right? And so there's merit to that argument. But when you're talking about a Palestinian woman, for example, learning how to make their own glass and creating their own double backs, their own maybe shitty-looking little bends their first time to make an entire wall of neon watermelons for Palestinian resistance, what's more important, that those double backs are perfect or the fact that that Palestinian woman made this glass work with her own hands, right? And so that kind of privileged attitude, right, of the neon glass.
Like, not
world.
Everybody has access to every the fanciest equipment. Doesn't mean not only and that, doesn't, but it shouldn't lower
needs,
the level.
Not
of the
only
artwork,
that, but
right,
like, there's joy. There's, right, to me, in looking at a piece of neon, right, that's been made by somebody who's learning. I get, right, to see that person on their learning journey. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it looks like any other sign that was made by any other sign shop. What's special about that?
Right.
As long as it's processed well and it'll survive. I mean, we had some. Right. Troubleshooting issues with the piece. Jube Abu Zaina. She was at the Museum of Glass show that we did in February, and it just recently came down in October. And we had some troubleshooting with it. I mean, it's a lot of glass on the wall, and there were some things, but, you know, and that was something that we talked to the institution about, too. It's, yeah, like, this is a woman, and this is what the show is called. It's called Redefining Neon Legacy,
yeah,
right? It's about teachers. So we showed neon educators and people who have learned from those educators,
sure,
all women and or gender, you know, non-binary. And Jude's work, I taught her. So I represented her teacher, and she represented my student. And that's what we were talking to the museum about. It's like, you know, not all of these pieces are going to be like plug and play neon, right, pieces that you can turn on and you don't have to think about. They're representative of a moment in time of this person's learning process and this, yeah, journey, wow, of them learning how to create their own narrative with their own hands. That is powerful. Mm-hmm. That is necessary. And this is what
art.
Has to happen.
That's art. Yeah.
And so that is very, very different for the neon world, not only for the general audiences that look at neon,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
to see a sign that looks maybe funky.
They expect everything to be perfect, right? They expect,
right,
the final product.
Well, maybe
to be
they don't
nice,
expect
right?
it, but
yeah,
but they know that something's different about,
yeah,
something,
yeah,
that they,
yeah,
see that isn't, right? Because all of the liquor stores, everything that they see in normal in their everyday life is,
right,
is very precise.
It's the final product.
And then it's,
yeah,
something different for the neon industry to look at these works in a different way without the judgment, without this, you know, air of superiority. I like to call the expectations, the rigid expectations that the neon industry puts on the craftsmanship, as patriarchal.
Yeah. Well, I think about it, like, it's so funny. I'm going to throw Calder out there as a perfect example. I've seen his earlier work that is coveted now. That shit was janky. Like, if you're missing, yeah, Alexander Calder's, like,
oh,
his,
okay,
earlier mobiles,
right,
which are in museums worth millions of dollars.
Right.
If you ever seen his earlier mobiles, you can see very obvious the welding marks.
Right.
You could see where he welded little tiny weights that are visible and not as hidden because he,
right,
didn't master that skill yet.
Right.
Like, you could see where he, like, got things a little weird. Like, the paint is a little off because he didn't have, like, really good yellows or reds yet.
Right.
Like,
and probably didn't powder coat stuff.
He was using wood still,
right,
is because he didn't, like, have metal yet. You know, like, I mean, like, these were, like, things. And those things are, like, valued and, like, historically, like, thought of. Like, look how amazing
his
earlier
stuff. Super rare.
They, like,
earlier
look at, like, his journey.
This.
And,
yeah,
like, and, like, so for me, it's, like, we covet those pieces. Mm-hmm. What's the difference of seeing a person's earlier work that's still aesthetically looks well, and just because it's, like, a little off because it's just not there yet, but it's just like, yeah, but this is the beauty of art. It's just like, wait, if it's good now and it's like a little rough, but like let's appreciate that roughness because man, just wait totally. Like 10 years from now. Totally. Like, and then we're going to appreciate that earlier piece even more.
Right. Well, like, but that yeah. also plays a hand in the conservation of it, because if it is a funky piece, if it does have issues with it, then you have to be aware of those things and how to treat them. And, you know, it's all related and it's all in conversation with itself. Yeah. But, you know, I think that neon is one of the only materials as a fine art medium that goes through this.
Yeah.
This need to really break out of this perfectionist yeah. mold, because it's how we're taught.
Yeah.
It's how everybody is taught. And yeah, so it's ingrained crazy. In us to think that way.
Yeah.
And we have to break out of that. And I think that also without even really thinking about it, general yeah. audiences are also, you know, sort of have this understanding of what yeah. neon is supposed to look like.
Yeah. And what's crazy is at least the conservators that I know, like, let's say that earlier piece of hers, like, got acquired. They're going to want to preserve the exact way she did it.
I know.
They're not going to want.
And that's the thing.
That's what's so wild about that, you know?
You level up out of that.
Yeah.
Like, what I say to a lot of my students yeah. is, you should have seen the first text yeah. I made. And you know what Bill said about it is, he said, wow, this is just so charming. It's like you had something to say and you just really needed to get it out.
Oh, yeah.
And I get goosebumps say, thinking about that every time I say it. Because, and I've, you know, told that to a ton of people, and it's really made an impression on them, and a way to think about this is that now, if I were to try to recreate that charm yeah. that he picked up on, I would not be able to do it. That yeah. is a moment in time in my bending life. I actually am going to be re-exhibiting that work soon with St. Joseph Society. And I have to recreate some of the units, and I'm going to try and see if I can make them as fun. It's going to be a weird process of trying to like go backwards and make them look as funky as the original units yeah, just yeah. to match. But yeah, those quirky little anomalies, like, they're magic when they happen in neon, because they're hard to get back once you've sort of aged out of it, you know, or like progressed out of that stage. And you're not supposed to have anomalies in the gas fill or in things, because that's not the way things go, but I try and make things buzz and have electrodes uncovered and have, you know, I like to do things differently, and I like when other people do it differently. And I think that it's important to be able to see somebody's own hand in work. It's always been how I am. And it's definitely a hard thing to achieve with this medium for sure, but it's cool when it happens.
Well, then, the last thing I want to mention then, the segue, that's a perfect segue into the show that you currently, that just opened recently over at the CJM, the Contemporary yeah. Jewish Museum, because the whole premise of that show is about doing this very thing. It's like, it's kind of exhibiting more work by more neon artists, but also, like, I think the premise was just kind of showing, like, the craftsmanship behind it. I think even, like, the scientific method behind yeah. it. And, you know, I just looking at some of the images of it, there's insane things. I don't even know how they made some of the stuff in that show.
Yeah, it's very anti-neon almost.
Yeah, but, like, it's really great. But, like, you know, mixed media, like, yeah. I mean, it's one of those things where it's, like, it's neon, but it's like another. I mean, you use this a lot today, and I love it. It's like leveling up. It's yeah. just like another level of neon. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, talk about this show, because I think this, and it's a She Bends curated show, right?
It is. Yeah. Normally we have She Bends : something, but the museum yeah. wanted us to have a main title and a subtitle, and so it would have been yeah. a lot of. And then, so the show is called First Light: Rituals in Glass and Neon Art, and it's about, I guess, in a nutshell, in my own way of saying it, it's talks about the ritualist, the devotional aspect of our practice, how it's akin to a ritual devotion. It's spiritual, it's transformative, and it's our method, the artist in the show's method of learning more about our place in the universe, learning about scientific, you know, aspects of the cosmos, and yeah, what it means to be human in this weird place that we're in, not just on the earth, but in the world. And so First Light refers to the moment, cosmic dawn, basically, like the moment of light, which is essentially what we're doing. All neon is plasma, right? Plasma yeah. is the fourth state of matter. It's ionized gases inside of a tube. And that's what you're seeing in the cosmos, in nebula. You're seeing ionized gases. Obviously, you have to see it with infrared. There's all sorts of things. But first light is also what James Webb's mission statement is. The James Webb telescope, which just replaced Hubble, I think within the last, couple years?
Yeah.
And when they released their first images, what they were saying was that they were looking for first light. They were looking for the oldest galaxies in the universe, and they found them. And that's what it refers to, is kind of, you know, comparing or sort of making a through line between what we're doing with our process and what's going on inside of a tube, right?
Yeah.
And what's going on up there, and how, you know, all we're all made of stardust and all that, you know, hokey pokey stuff. But a lot of the artists in the show are doing things like, you know, there's sound that affects works. There's sound that's emitted by works through frequency and things like that. So there's all sorts of ways that there's, you know, audience engagement with works in the show. There's non-traditional stuff abound. And then we also have a couple of process tables. So we set up a bending table, kind of frozen in time, that has all of the bending equipment on it and all of the paraphernalia that you would normally see on a bending table is the first thing that you see when you walk in to the exhibit. And then one of the last rooms has a bombarding table, which is what we call the process of getting tubes to light up. We call it bombarding. And so, you know, it's very scientific looking apparatus with scientific glass. The museum was, you know, really on board with a lot of the more experimental stuff that we wanted to do, and super, super generous. And you know, this is an example of one of those shows where we really pared things down and got more intentional with stuff. And because of that, we had less works, we had less artists, but we were able to provide more actual support to artists to come out, to be involved in talks, to stay out here in San Francisco for, you know, a couple of nights, and to even commission new works. So some of the works in the show are either remakes of old works that we saw. In my case, I had to remake it. And I'm glad I did. But some works are entirely new commissions and pieces that were super experimental. The artists had these grand ideas of things that they wanted to make, and this was the first opportunity that they got, and they got support for it. So we're really happy with the opportunity to be able to do that. In my case, with my piece, I'm especially grateful for the opportunity to remake the work, because I realize how far I've come with glass bending. And it's not all the time that you get to remake the exact same piece, however many years apart. The first time was in 2018, you know, and really examine how far you've come with your glasswork. Because there are a lot of days where I'm in the studio and I'm like, it's as if I haven't even progressed. Like, you know, you're just like breaking shit left and right, and you're like, why? What am I doing with my life? You know, like a lot of days I've come home and complained to my husband about I can't even believe, like, am I even progressing at all? And I am super grateful to see that, yeah, I had what was super super difficult for me to make, you know, in 2018, because I wrestled with the glass, was easier in that respect for me this time.
Cool. Well, Meryl, thanks for coming on this podcast. Yeah. It was really great.
Thanks for having me.
This is great. I've learned so much
about neon.
No, I mean, I was so interested in this conversation. I've learned so much about the science of this, the mechanical part about this, the craftsmanship of it. I felt like I was in a 1-hour class about it, and I'm ready to take a test about it. That's literally where I'm at. And this was great. I wish there was a class like this when I was in college, to be honest. And
well, anybody's welcome. I do workshops in my studio.
Yeah.
Hit me up on SheBenz or on my website.
And is that where they can find where they can do workshops? Is that on the SheBenz website or your own website?
My own website has the classes, but you know, either is fine. We are friendly on both websites, so you can reach out either place for anything neon related, whether it's a commission. SheBenz does commissions. I do workshops, and we're always looking for artist portfolios from people who are making their own neon work. Yeah, we're always looking for new art. So,
And how long is the show open up over at the Contemporary Jewish
Till Museum? April 8th.
April 8th, okay.
And there's going to be some programming coming up. I'm not sure exact dates on that, but we have a couple of cool things in mind within the vein of the show. Yeah.
Cool. All right. Thanks.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thanks for listening, everyone. And thanks again to Meryl for coming on to the podcast. To learn more about her and her work, visit her website at merylpataki.com. To learn more about She Bends, visit shebends.com. I'll be sure to have the info up on the podcast website as well. First Light Rituals of Glass and Neon Art will be up at the CJM in San Francisco until April 28th. Visit thecjm.org for more info. Lastly, be sure to subscribe to the podcast wherever you listen to podcasts and leave a review if you can. Till next time, everyone.